Alan.
What?
How much of the original Iron Chef did you watch?
The original, like, from Japan?
Yeah.
Very little. I only remember I had a friend in high school named Spencer, and he was into it. And a few times I was at his house and we watched it like with subtitle or not with subtitles, with dubbed English.
Yeah.
But I didn't care about food at all in high school. I mean, besides
at that point,
I liked right. pizza and pasta and hot dogs and, but I was not interested in
this
show.
This is an illustration of our generational gap, I guess.
Mm.
Because I mean, when I was interested in food, I think it was off the Food Network by the time I actually started cooking as a career.
Mm.
But, you know, I was always interested in food and I watched the Food Network lots before I ever became a cook or a chef or anything. Or a commie or a dishwasher.
Or a commie? I didn't know I was
Alan,
doing
not
a
red commie.
Podcast with a pinko. Oh my goodness.
So I used to watch it religiously. I watched a lot of it. I watched a lot of episodes of it.
Mm.
And just like last week, I think since we last recorded, I stumbled across, I was looking for, what was it? I was looking on YouTube for recipes for something. I think it just ran. I wasn't actually looking for recipes for Mapo Tofu, but because I at one point was obsessed with looking for recipes for Mapo Tofu, they still pop up every now and then in my YouTube recommendations.
Mm.
And yeah, there was like a YouTube demo of making Mapo Tofu by who used to be Iron Chef Chinese, I believe, in the Japanese version of the show. His name is Chen Kenichi.
Oh, okay. Sorry, and that's what they called him? They called him Iron Chef Chinese?
That's right. There was Iron Chef Chinese, who is Chen Kenichi. There was Iron Chef Japanese, who was, for the most of the run of the show, was Masaharu Morimoto, who is also famous for being on Iron Chef America.
Right. Where it would have been very different if he had been referred to as Iron Chef Japanese, right? But
they didn't have that on the American show, I guess, hey?
Like, were they just referred to people by their cooking specialty and ancestry?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Kenichi, by the way, sounds like a very Japanese name, not a Chinese name at all.
He's a Japanese dude.
Okay, but he specializes.
They're all Japanese people because they're on a Japanese show.
Yeah, but he specializes in Chinese.
Yeah, but exactly. There's a lot of Chinese cuisine in Japan, and he's like a Chinese chef from Japan.
Yeah.
Speaks Japanese. He's fully Japanese, but he just specializes in Chinese cuisine.
Okay. And then there was a third Iron Chef?
There were four for most of the run of the show. There was Iron Chef French, Hiroyuki Sakai, I believe was his name. And then Iron Chef Italian, oh God, come on, Shale, you can do it. Masahiko Kobe, oh my God, I can't believe I remembered.
And these are the four, are these meant to represent like four pillars of global cuisine?
Of like global cuisine, I think. Yeah.
French,
yeah.
Italian, Chinese, and Japanese. Okay, got it.
Yeah, that's right. And there was also, I don't know if there were any other sort of like swap outs, but I think in the first season, Iron Chef Japanese was not Masaharu Morimoto. It was Roksaburo Michiba was the Iron Chef Japanese in the first season.
And what became of him?
What's that?
Well, what became of him?
I don't know. He left the show for some reason. I don't know. Maybe he didn't like it. Who knows?
Hmm.
Or maybe he replaced Morimoto. I'm not sure. Like, I don't think they really played those shows in order on the Food Network in North America. So it's kind of hard to like fully know, like, you know, what the order of when who was who is, but. Anyway, so I caught a video of Ken Shinichi, Chen Kenichi making mapo tofu, and I watched it, and it was pretty entertaining. And then I was like, man, I should just like go back and see if I can find any old Japanese Iron Chef episodes on YouTube. And surprising no one, there are tons of them.
Right.
And so I watched a couple, but man, it's weird because like, so firstly, there's more than one, I guess, release of it with like different dubbed voices. Okay. And stuff.
Yeah.
And at first I couldn't find copies of the episodes with the voices that were dubbed when they aired on the Food Network.
Mm.
And so the first couple that I tried to watch had like, you know, dubbed voices that I didn't recognize, and it was like super jarring. I was like, these are not the people, even though they're dubbed voices anyways, like, right, they're not the real people's voices anyways.
Yeah,
it was just like, man, it was such a weird experience.
It's like seeing when you listen to a radio host for years and years and then you see them in person or on video and you're like, what the, that's, yeah, not what you're supposed of to look like. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Or when you listen to a podcaster all the time and you've never seen a picture of their face, and then you one day Google them or run into their like Instagram account and you're like, whoa, wait, what?
Right. Yeah.
yeah. Anyway, so I watched a bunch. Man, that show is fascinating. Like, you don't really get to see a ton of what's going on in terms of the preparation, but just the way they talk about the food and the way they talk about the dishes is really interesting. I think like the one thing that I sort of noticed is that, you know, there's a real, you know, in Japanese cuisine, there's like a real history about sort of like the accepted way for every dish to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are commentating on the cooking that's going on Iron Chef are like really knowledgeable about those sort of, I don't know, techniques or dogmas. I don't know. But it's really interesting because, like, you know, part of Iron Chef is like this creativity aspect of it, coming up with a dish that maybe your competitor isn't going to, you know, like something special from your oeuvre or something. And so like in just about every episode, the people who are commentating on the food being made are being like, oh, he's doing that, that's not very traditional, or like, that's really strange for that dish. And then they try it and then they're like, oh, this actually works really well, but it's not really how this dish is supposed to be. I don't know, it's just really, it's funny to hear the trepidation. But yeah, I don't know. I've recently rewatched a few episodes of the Japanese Iron Chef, and man, I'm like thinking about trying to find a bunch of episodes that are not dubbed, that are just in the original Japanese, so that I can like watch them and listen and try and improve my Japanese, because I'm trying to learn Japanese right now. So just another thing that I can add into my like, to my media diet of strictly Japanese things.
Right. It's funny because on the one hand, I can see like the narrow way that I see old world and new world is like, yeah, the old world is very like, they only want to see things done the traditional way, which is silly, but is not true.
Right.
Yeah. But also it's good for television, for like, if they're commentating on innovative cooking for a
Japanese audience,
traditional audience, they're like, oh my goodness, this is not how this usual dish is performed. I don't know.
And totally.
Then, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. They like, and the way that they try to inform the viewership about what's going on, to make the show digestible to people who may not be chefs or whatever, is like, yeah, that's a really interesting part of how they structure that commentary. But it's also sometimes like the judges, like you can hear like naked fear in their voice when they're about to try a new dish or something. Right. They're like, I've never seen this before. It's pretty good.
That's good TV.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
pretty good.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it. See that, Alan? You can teach an old dog new tricks.
You nailed it.
Boom.
Do you mean because you said co-host?
I haven't even been rehearsing.
Because you said co-host instead of dude?
Exactly. Instead of rando or whatever. Yeah, so do we have any follow-up, Alan?
I don't really have any follow-up.
Okay. I do have follow-up. This whole episode might be follow-up, actually, sort of.
Okay.
Or sort of like that. I mean, it sort of feels a little bit now like just about everything we talk about has already been discussed a little bit on the podcast previously. So does that make every conversation that we have follow-up? Kind of. I don't know.
Are you think we're becoming stale, or what do you mean?
I hope not. Hopefully we're just like getting a better perspective on the things, on the topics that interest us, and are coming to new realizations about that and sharing them with the audience. That's my optimistic take.
Like, we've now surveyed all of the kind of information and trends available to us, and now we can just really delve into.
That's right.
The analysis.
Now we can do deep dives.
Okay. Okay. So with that buildup, your follow-up must be very important about something critical to the state of gastronomy in our fair city. What is it?
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Okay. Well, follow-up one, I don't know, maybe this is a new topic actually, but, you know, I've been cooking a lot of Japanese food.
Right.
And I've been continuing to try to sort of like expand the number of things that I'm doing and the number of techniques that I'm learning and dishes that I'm aware of and dishes that I know how to cook. But I've sort of been steering clear of ramen.
Mm.
Because it seems like a pretty deep rabbit hole.
Yes.
You know? And it's also like, I mean, it takes a lot of time and effort to do it correctly.
From scratch,
yeah. Yeah, I haven't been avoiding ramen, not from scratch, really. but I have been avoiding the idea of like, yeah, doing it top to bottom, front to back, completely from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of interesting because, like, I don't know. Do you know that, like, I did a ramen pop-up, like, once upon a time?
Yeah.
A long time ago.
That's, like, part of your lore. I'm very aware that you did. Was it out of Elm or no?
No, it was out of Dutchess, actually. I mean, I did a lot of the prep. It was while I was working at Elm, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of the prep in the first Elm kitchen
and in the Drift food when it was truck. Like isn't have we had this isn't that how we met? You were doing prep for it in the Drift food truck, or that was something unrelated?
I think that was a different thing. That was a different pop-up.
Oh yeah.
I don't think I did any of the prep for the ramen pop-up in the Drift food truck,
but the service was at Dutchess.
Yeah, the service was at, so Dutchess used to be like it's a big kind of open space now, but it kind of used to be divided into two spaces. So there was like the bakery space, and then shortly after that, there was a space beside it that was like their provisions mm-hmm. shop, mm-hmm. Where they sold equipment and baking supplies and things like that. But while they were renovating it to be the provisions shop, it was like not in use. Or maybe, actually, I don't exactly remember the timeline. It was either before they put the provisions shop in the little shop that was next door, or after they decided that they were going to tear out the provisions shop and open the whole place up
mm-hmm.
and put the provisions shop just like inside the regular part of the bakery. Mm-hmm. It was during one of those renovations. but they currently didn't have anything installed in like the little shop that was next door. Friend of the show Clayton and I were looking for a spot to do a ramen pop-up, and Clayton was working at Duchess at the time, and we both knew the owners of Duchess and stuff, and we asked if we could use that space, and they said yes, and so we did it. It was like one night only, but it turned out to be like extremely popular and successful. We had a huge lineup that went down the block, and I think we did a pretty decent job of making ramen for, at the time Clayton had been to Japan, but I had never been. So all of my experiences with ramen were trying as many various bowls as I could in North America. And so I, you know, like I had sort of a rudimentary understanding of what it should be like. And I think we did a pretty decent job of making something that was good and enjoyable. But looking back on it now, it's sort of like, I don't know, it just feels like I would have done things a lot differently, you know, knowing now what I know about ramen. I guess that's always
probably true of almost any meal that was cooked 15 years ago or 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's true. But yeah, I don't know. It's just funny because like at the time, I thought that we did a pretty good job of trying to make it authentic and stuff. But now, you know, now when I look at it, I'm like, oh, that's a little bit embarrassing.
I wonder, is there like, do you know, are there kind of blog posts or something from that day that I could go read?
I don't know about blog posts specifically, but I definitely have a menu.
Was Sharon Yao there? I bet there's a blog post about it.
Oh, I'll bet you're right, actually. Huh, that's interesting.
Anyways.
Should look that up. There were definitely some food bloggers there. I don't remember who all was there, but...
Because we're talking about, what, 2012 or something like that, or...
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. 2012 or 2013.
Oh, wait, I'm going to look into it.
Okay. Oh, we'll have another piece of follow-up. Okay. I'll dig up the menu, too. I'll try to remember to dig up the menu for it.
Okay, anyways.
I think maybe we had two bowls, or maybe we only had one bowl. Can't remember. One bowl and then, like, a couple of different... sides that you could order and so anyways, I think like back then I sort of like considered myself to be a bit of a ramen aficionado and I know, right? That's what's embarrassing.
It was a different time. And it's okay.
It was a different time. Yeah. And now I know how much I don't know about ramen, so it's interesting because since I've gotten back from Japan, I've been thinking about that quite a bit because I think like, you know, previously, like a few years ago or something, that would have been like my reason to go would be, you know, to like find out a whole bunch of stuff about ramen and then come back and make a whole bunch of ramen. And, you know, but since I got back, I've sort of been hesitating a little bit to get into the ramen side of things because it's so much deeper than I kind of actually knew. And, you know, it just feels to me a little bit more intimidating now for some reason, now that I know more about it.
Right.
But I think on a previous episode, I had mentioned that I was thinking about trying to find some like local ducks.
Right.
And I haven't found any yet, although I may have like a potential source to get a couple.
Marius.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Marius.
I don't know about...
Marius sells ducks?
I haven't bought from him in the last couple of years, but he used to provide ducks to Clementine.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah, I knew... I definitely bought geese from him before, but I guess I probably knew that he had ducks, but maybe for some reason it wasn't like at the front of my brain or something like that. But yeah, Four Whistle Farms, that's Marius. So yeah, that's a good idea. Anyways, I think I had mentioned thinking about getting some ducks, and then I think my mom heard that, and she was at Costco last week, and she was like, oh, there's ducks here. Do you want me to get you some? And I was like... Oh, sure, why not?
Yeah.
So my mom bought me two Brome Lake ducks from Costco, and then I had them in my fridge this week, and I was like, oh, okay, what am I going to do with these ducks? Like, you know, my immediate sort of like, what would I do with these ducks would be, you know, I would take them apart and confit the legs and maybe lightly cure the breasts and have the breasts ready to like sear or do something like that. And then maybe I would use the confit from the legs to, I don't know, make a cassoulet or something like that. Like, a, you know, that would be sort of my normal at home, somewhat traditional approach to what, for what to do with some whole ducks. And render out a bunch of the fat and use it for other things and yada, yada, yada. But I didn't really want to do that because it sounded boring to me. And then I was like, well, what, you don't think I just think that that's boring?
Confit and magret of duck are so boring now.
It's not that it's not good food.
And ever, it's, ever it, since it,
it's
you
only
went to
boring
Japan.
To me because it's just so like it's so so much a part of it's so much like how I always utilize ducks.
I'm just teasing you. I know that you still enjoy confit. I understand the malaise of home cooking that can settle on one.
Yeah, I like it. It feels like, you know, when you have some like ingredients that you're excited about, it feels like a bit of a cheat, or you're doing yourself a little bit of a disservice if you don't use that opportunity to teach yourself something new or something. I don't know. That's sort of how I feel about it. And sometimes you just don't have the energy to do that with every piece of food that enters your house. But I was kind of like, well, you know, like having two ducks in my fridge, I want to do something interesting with it. So then I was thinking about like, okay, well, maybe I'll just like see if Kenji has any videos about duck preparations, or maybe I'll look at Chinese Cooking Demystified or something. But then I was like, I mean, I think duck ramen is like a relatively common thing. I'll bet there's like a whole bunch of information about duck ramen on the internet and duck ramen on YouTube. And so maybe I should just see what that's all about. And in the, and part of the reason why it occurred to me is because, like, you know, if I'm going to go to the trouble of making ramen at home, I obviously have to make the soup, but I don't always have like bones on hand and things like that. So, you know, if I wanted to start making ramen, I would just have to go out and buy some pork bones or something like that. But, you know, I had these two whole ducks in my fridge. So I was like, well, you know, I'm going to make stock from these. I'm going to, you know, maybe ramen is a good thing to do with them. And so then I, started down this rabbit hole of turning the two ducks that my mom bought for me into duck ramen. And I'm like, I don't know, three quarters of the way there. I tested out a couple of noodle recipes last night. And I made the broth and...
Hold on. The noodle, you said you tried a couple noodle recipes. Did you, you went out and got the salts that are required?
The what?
I've never made ramen noodles, but I have read the Momofuku cookbook. And they talk about
the kansui.
Is that what it is? The there's some kind of
normally
the calcium chloride or something that you need for it.
Yeah, or potassium chloride.
Oh, okay. That sounds more correct.
Yeah. Yeah. You can buy potassium chloride in a liquid form pretty readily in most of the Asian markets here. So yeah. I went and bought some
Even Lucky 97?
Yep. That's where I bought it, Lucky 97. You can buy kansui there.
What part of the store is that in?
It's in the aisle where there are, I think it's in the, it's not in the baking supplies aisle. The baking supplies aisle is like a lot of Western ingredients and a few Asian ingredients. It's in the aisle, I think, where most of the vinegars and things are.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And they have a couple of different brands. There is a brand, I can't remember what it's called, but it's just called straight, like the label on the bottle just says lye water.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then there's another brand with a yellow and blue label, and it's called, I think maybe it says potassium chloride on it or something. Anyway, yeah, you can buy it in Lucky. In fact, I knew that you could buy it at Lucky because when I did my ramen pop up, like all those years ago, that's where that's where I was able to find some. But I think it's more commonly available in Asian grocery stores than it was then, because I know they have it at TNT as well. I saw it there like a few weeks ago.
Okay.
Yep. So you don't have
definitely
to
have gone there.
You no longer have to. Like, I think it was really hard to find, like, previously, because it, you know, like, for such a long time, like, everything that you would see on the internet about making ramen noodles, like, in North America, like, use the, I mean, I don't really, is it, I'm not 100% sure. I think I heard of it from David Chang, but I think it might be a technique that was made popular by Harold McGee. I'm not 100% sure, but there's like this thing that you can do where you take baking powder or baking soda and put it in the oven at a certain time and temperature, and it changes it chemically to be much more alkaline. And so when you see a lot of like recipes online in English for how to make ramen noodles, they recommend this technique of taking baking soda and putting it in the oven and then using that as your alkaline salt or whatever. But yeah, you can buy like the liquid pretty readily now. So I don't think that that's really usually necessary anymore, but I don't know, maybe in certain parts of the States, it's still hard to get. And I think it's probably not so hard to get because ramen became so popular and people trying to make ramen noodles became more popular or something. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, I went out and procured that. And I also procured some rye flour because a few of the variations that I saw for duck ramen online used like a noodle that had a small amount of rye flour in it. So that was what I tried last night, was making ramen noodles with rye flour. And they turned out really nice, actually. So that's probably what I'm going to do. But I'm probably going to test a couple of recipes without rye flour, too, just for fun.
Okay. Duck and rye ramen makes me... There's this thing that I've had in the back of my head that maybe I've, like... I don't think we've talked about before, but this idea of taking some of the really hearty, comforting soups of Europe and, like, trying to present them and prepare them in a way that's more like something like the Korean hot pot soups and stuff like that. And this idea of like duck and rye flour noodles makes me think of that, where it's like, what, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like the, for instance, the, there's an Austrian stew called Wilderer Pfandl, which just means like, it's like the poacher's feast. So it's usually just like this pan that has like a wild mushroom kind of ragu mix and some kind of game meat and some kind of dumpling. And it's usually exactly how you would imagine a rustic European hunter's stew is presented. But you could make it a lot more like, say, a Korean soup, where like all of the, like make a broth based on game and mushrooms and then put the components in, like kind of like group them together in this kind of, attractive way in the bowl and boil them in the bowl.
Right. And have them in a stone bowl so that it's boiling when it comes to the table. And like, make the dumplings out of the, make stuffed dumplings instead of maybe what would just be like a, you know, a bready rye dumpling or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And other ideas like there's like an Austrian soup, Frittatensuppe, which is like, it's basically a noodle soup. But then instead of noodles, it's pancakes, like thin, like crepe-like pancakes cut really thin. And it's usually just pancakes and broth. But like you could reimagine that as, because Austrians love pork as much as the Japanese do, you could like reimagine that as this like beautiful ramen bowl with all kinds of different components. And instead of the noodles, you have the
strips of
frittaten, like
crepe,
the,
yeah.
Yeah. And sorry, that's what your duck and rye... And maybe duck and rye noodle ramen is just a regular thing for most Japanese people. But yeah, to me, it's like, oh, that's starting to sound very European.
Yeah. I wonder, like, I don't know historically, like where, you know, like how long they've been making duck ramen. I don't know how long, you know, duck has really, you know, been eaten in Japan. So I, yeah, it's hard for me to say. I feel like this week I'm less informed about the connection between European and Japanese food than I was 2 weeks ago, because I read a few things that like made me feel like I have absolutely no idea of like what all of the connections are between Western and Japanese food. And I have a little bit of follow-up about that as well.
Is that a segue?
It would be such a great segue, but I'm not quite done talking about the duck ramen. So I'm going to back off.
That you haven't even actually eaten yet, right?
That's right. Yeah. So okay. I'm hoping to eat it on Wednesday. I'm going to have my parents over. And so me and my parents and my sister and maybe my brother will get to try it. So yeah, I have yet to make the tare for it. Mm-hmm. And I have yet to make like the flavored oil for it. But the flavored oil, in most of the like duck ramen recipes that I found on YouTube and online, apparently green onion is something that's paired with duck a lot in Japan. And so for the duck ramen, they usually make like a flavored oil out of green onion. So I'll just use duck fat and green onion to make the flavored oil. And the tare, I haven't really figured out yet. I think it's going to be fairly traditional, so it's normally like sake and soy sauce and sugar and then sometimes dashi and then sometimes some other kind of like umami-enhancing ingredients. Haven't quite figured out what I'm going to do for the tare yet, but sort of like hopefully figure that out later today or something. And then we're recording on Monday, and I'm going to serve it on Wednesday. So I still have, I guess, 2 days to figure that out. And I went to make the ramen eggs last night. Oh man, this is such a great piece of follow-up because it has so many tangents. So one piece of follow-up could be a whole episode. But
we'll
I went to make the ajitama, the ramen eggs, last night. And I was making them fairly often right when I got back from Japan, not to have with ramen that I made, but to like enhance, you know, store-bought ramen that I bought or whatever, or just to have like with my lunch or something. I just, you know, those ramen eggs are so delicious. So I was making them quite a bit when I got back. But I think I mentioned to you previously that like I was having quite a bit of trouble, you know, finding a way to make sure that my eggs were peelable in a way that they weren't like breaking all the time. And the one way to really ensure that is to pressure cook your eggs. Like that trick actually works. Like if you pressure cook your eggs and then you do like a rapid release of the pressure, it makes the eggshells basically like fall off when you go to peel your eggs. But it's also a little bit tricky because you have to get the exact amount of water and the exact weight of eggs and the exact time right. And so you have to sacrifice a few eggs to testing out like how that balance will work out in every different pressure cooker that you intend to use. And I hadn't done that for my Instant Pot. But yesterday I was like, okay, I'm going to figure this out because I want to be able to make a bunch of ramen eggs for this ramen. And I want the eggs to look really nice and pristine. So I want to be able to peel them easily. So I did a couple of tests in my Instant Pot. So basically I set it to like high pressure for 1 minute and then waited 30 seconds and did a rapid release, which was, I think I got that from the Instapot website or something.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
And I did that and the egg that I tried was like a little undercooked. So then I tried the same thing, except I did high pressure, 3 minutes cook time. And then instead of waiting 30 seconds, I immediately rapid released. And the egg that I did with that technique was perfect. So I was like, oh, okay, great. So then I put the same amount of water in. Like you have to use fresh cold water every time also, because the because the time that it takes to cook the egg is partially the time that it takes for the water to heat up and the pressure to build right. up in the pressure cooker. So you have to use the same amount of water mm-hmm. to get the same timing every time. Mm-hmm. But I put in 8 eggs instead of 1 egg, and I did the exact same thing with the exact same amount of water, but they were all overcooked. So I don't know. I'm in a bit of a pickle now because I'm not really sure. Like I'm assuming that because there was a fair amount of mass of cold eggs in the pressure cooker, mm-hmm. it took longer for the steam to build up. Like I imagine
right, like they were fresh out of the fridge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I see you. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, they're fresh out of the fridge, which, mm-hmm. You know, like whether they're fresh out of the fridge or room temperature, I mean, it would be a different cook time for sure, but it shouldn't mm-hmm. really, like, compared to the heat that they're going to be at once the pressure builds up inside the pressure cooker, like they're, you know, like the difference between 4 degrees Celsius and 20 degrees Celsius is way smaller than the difference between 20 degrees Celsius and 112 degrees Celsius or whatever.
Right. But the mass, like going from 1 egg to
8 eggs.
8 eggs. It's going from 2 ounces to a pound.
Yeah. Right?
So it's like,
that's that shouldn't make that big a difference because like they're like, you're just steaming them. Like I was using like a small amount of water in the bottom of the pressure cooker and the eggs are sitting up on like a little, what do you call that? Trivet, I guess.
A little basket.
Yeah. So, you know, it should take the water the same amount of time to boil, but I think maybe what's happening is it takes longer for the steam to build up because the eggs are cold. And so the steam that's coming off of the water once it boils is condensing on the eggs for quite a bit longer while the eggs mm-hmm. get over that threshold of temperature where the steam is no longer like condensing on them all the time. And so that takes a much longer time for the steam to actually build up enough so that the pressure starts to go up and then it starts the pressure cooking timer. So I don't know. It was kind of frustrating though, because I spent 2 eggs on figuring out what time and temperature I needed. And then I had, I didn't have a full dozen. So, but I put 8 more eggs in and I had 1 egg left over from the dozen eggs that I had in my fridge. And then I accidentally hard boiled all 8 of those of those eggs, and so I was like really sad.
Now you can make Japanese egg salad sandwiches.
I was really sad, and my sister was there to see it, and she was like, well, you could make egg salad. And I will make egg salad, but at the time I was a little too disheartened to just be like, oh, great idea, everyone.
Oh, Shail, it'll be okay.
I know they'll be delicious. It's fine. I'll love to have that egg salad to take with me as for my work lunches this week. But yeah, no eggs will be wasted in the making of these ajitama. But I was pretty sad because I did really spend a lot of time. Well, I mean, you know, an hour ish figuring out what, you know, what the right time and temperature would be to cook these eggs at in my pressure cooker. And now I basically have no idea how long it takes to cook 8 eggs. So I'm kind of back at square one. So either I cook the eggs individually one at a time to get them right, or I just like, you know, put 8 more eggs in my pressure cooker and hope for the best.
Such are the trials and tribulations of batching up, right?
Yeah, seriously. It's rough. I don't know. Maybe if I do 4 at a time and just lower the time by a minute, it'll work out.
Or go back in time and buy your eggs 3 weeks ago and let them sit in your fridge, and then you can just hard boil them boil them the normal way, and they'll peel just fine.
Yeah, I like the pressure cooking way though. It's fun.
Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah. So yeah, that's it. I'm gonna make duck ramen. Moving right along.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. So at some point during the last episode that we released, we talked about, when we were talking about the French menu that was presented at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, mm-hmm. You know, we got on the topic of like, you know, how French food was sort of like globally kind of the like recognized fancy food or something like that. And then it occurred to me that, you know, there is like sort of a, I don't know if it's like fetishization or something, but like, you know, there's like a little bit, like there was some noticeable aspects of that in Japanese culture while I was in Japan. Like, mm-hmm. for instance, there's like what looks like a French chef, a statue of a French chef on top of one of the buildings on Kapabashi. There are a lot of like markets that, you know, have French food, French ingredients. And there's, you know, like mm-hmm. sort of a lot of hype around how French food is like very fancy in Japan. And I was kind of curious mm-hmm. about that after we recorded. So I did a little digging on the internet. And I found some like really interesting connections. I don't remember everything like sort of off the top of my head, but I found a few articles that are really informative about the connections between French and Japanese food. Mm-hmm. There's like a couple of sort of points in time when a lot of sort of like trade and yeah, there are a couple different times during the 19th and 20th century where there was like sort of a strong, like a strengthening of diplomatic ties between France and Japan. And I'm not exactly sure of like the historical context for those things, but they're pretty well documented. And like there's a bunch of writing and a bunch of like theorization on the internet about how those sort of like cross pollinations of ideas happen between France and Japan, and how, you know, there wound up being a lot more sort of like French culinary influence in Japan and vice versa.
Well, can I speculate?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like even despite our post-Second World War ideas of like how the Americans see the French, like historically America and France have been very close allies because they were both enemies of the British, like from the Revolutionary War on.
Right.
And America is the one that pointed their guns at Japan in the 19th century and said, open your markets to us. And so since then, and definitely since the Second World War, like there's been huge American economic influence in Japan.
Right.
And I bet that the French, like the French influence like came with that in a way, or like it was,
oh, maybe
they were both friends of the Americans maybe. But anyways, I don't actually know the history, but
yeah. And I didn't see anything specifically about that in any of the articles that mm-hmm. I read. But I'm sure that's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that I did see that I thought was very interesting, and there's like an article that has some pretty good information and some pretty strong, like it makes a pretty strong argument for this sort of like being a realistic sort of speculation, historical speculation. But the article that I read, you know, said that there was a big influx of like French people to Japan in like the mid 50s. And
oh, why?
I don't know, maybe because of France's ties to America. I don't know. It's,
yeah, like would it have something to do with, because it was after the Second World War, France basically reinvaded Vietnam. I wonder if there was like some kind of emigre.
Right. It may have been around that time. It may have, I don't know, may have been a colonization play, or it may have been French soldiers from, you know, being in Southeast Asia and like being close to Japan and coming over. Mm. I don't really know. Mm. But yeah, in the mid 50s, apparently there was like a bunch of cultural, like a renewed cultural cross-pollination between Japan and France. And this article that I read, which I will put a link to in the show notes, makes a pretty good case for saying that like that Japanese kaiseki food, like kaiseki dining, which is like a meal that you have where it's like multiple courses of like really small, simple dishes that are like prepared kind of in season for the ingredients that mm-hmm. are being served, and the menu is kind of built around a season and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. like a strong case to be made that like nouvelle cuisine in France was heavily influenced by kaiseki food, which is like, you know, has a long tradition in Japan. I'm sure that how it's prepared and with what ingredients and how it's presented have changed a lot over time. But like, there apparently is like, you know, historical record of kaiseki meals being served in like the 6th century in Japan.
Right.
So it's like a long history of this culinary practice. And yeah, this article posits that like nouvelle cuisine was highly influenced by French chefs going to Japan and having kaiseki meals and coming back and being like, hey, we got to do this like seasonal thing.
That's interesting. I'd be very curious to know what the documented historical connections are, because the way that it's like, not in a historical way, but in a like, you know, in culinary, the culinary tradition and the culinary education tradition here, like I take for granted that the French did that as well.
Right. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
exactly.
They obviously didn't call it kaiseki, and it maybe wasn't done. When I think of like the elaborate French meals of the nobility, in my mind, they're not the same as the really focused and minimalist aesthetic
Nouvelle.
Of a kaiseki. But yeah, like, I'd be curious to know what the actual, what the documented connections are. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the article goes into it quite a bit more detail, but at the same time, it's not trying to say that like the French stole those ideas or something like that. It's
right.
just like,
yeah.
you know, it's an influence thing, right? It's a cross pollination of ideas. It doesn't even claim that kaiseki has always been the way that it is now, you know? And it doesn't say that, you know, like the people who during the time of the rise of nouvelle cuisine in France, like, you know, whether those ideas or whether the influence for that movement in France came from kaiseki. Obviously, the people who were a part of that movement in France had their own sets of ideas of how to do it and their own, you know, their own creative road that they were on. And, you know, but it was just interesting to see that, because, yeah, I think the assumption is that, like, you know, and partially because French fine dining is so iconic, I think there's like a predisposition to thinking that like those types of food movements are led by, you know, strictly by French culinary traditions. But, you know, it's always interesting to find out exactly how intermixed all of our food culture is, like, you know,
yes,
and like historically. And I don't know, it's fun and weird to, you know, think that like nightshades just didn't exist in Europe until Europeans came to North America. Like that's a crazy thing to consider, so that there were no tomatoes in Italy until, you know, after Europeans came to North America and brought them back.
That used to be my default. I was like, imagine Italy with no tomatoes. Like that's what pre-Columbian, but the crazier things, there were no chilies in Asia.
That's crazy.
Like that's crazy.
That's crazy.
That's like a fundamental change in the flavor profile of dozens of cuisines.
Yeah.
Over a couple hundred years, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I thought that was pretty interesting. It, you know, like a little thing that we talked about in the show, you know, sparked this like little bit of curiosity. And then I Googled something and I found this like, you know, really interesting perspective that I wasn't expecting to find. So I'll put a link to it in the show notes. People can check it out.
It's also to me a good callback to the Jonathan Gold piece called Herrings and Fur.
Right.
About that exact same thing. Like it's really none of the traditions that you consider pure or whatever, or are really that. It's really about cross pollination.
Yeah.
And one other thing that I would chuck out there, there's a Jeffrey Steingarten piece. I think it's called Borders or Borderlands,
okay.
like from Vogue magazine. That's kind of about the same thing, but yeah, like more about how the entire world is a borderland. And you think about there's the border between California and Mexico, and there's, you know, the marginal region between. But like really, we're all living in this kind of, these border regions where ideas are just being passed back and forth. So
totally. Yeah, like we were talking about that last week or last episode, I think, when we were talking about Alsace, you know, like,
yes,
it's currently French. I don't think it always was French. It's gone back and forth between being French and German, like a couple of, or like several times. And the food there is like, you know, kind of French food, but like heavily German influenced and not really like the food anywhere else in France, but has its own character because of that. And yeah, I don't know. Mm. It's interesting. And then, I guess also sort of, along the lines of what we were talking about last week, you had, like, right in the dying moments of the episode, you came across an article, where someone had cooked the meal from the Chicago
in the White City.
1893 World's Fair. The article was called, the menu was printed in a book called Devil in the White City, which is where we think Spencer took a picture of it. Mm-hmm. And then the article is called Devil in the White City Feast. And it's basically a blog article discussing someone who found that menu in the book and then decided to try to recreate it. And yeah, it's pretty interesting. It feels like pretty, I don't know, like it feels quite like a layman's interpretation of what it would be like. I don't know necessarily if anyone in that group that was cooking the meal was a chef or anything like that, but.
And to be clear, it's like there are instances where food scholars or like people who know a great deal about historical cooking find old menus and cook through it as accurately as they can.
Yeah, this is not like that.
This is not that. Yeah. But it still is interesting. And they did at least some research from what little scrolling I did through it. Like it.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like they found some information that we didn't have when we were trying to go through the menu, and some of the assumptions.
They don't really divulge a lot of that. They don't really divulge a lot of that because they say, like, because we were specifically, one of the things we were interested in, one of several, was the Romain Fantaisie, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The sorbet course. And they do say in that blog post, if I remember, they're like, it turns out Romain Fantaisie is a highly alcoholic sorbet.
Yeah, that's
but they don't tell you how they know that. And we tried to find that out. And we couldn't find any source material that.
Yeah, exactly. Right, that was the only reference to Romain Fantaisie on that we could find on Google was like that blog post. So right. Yeah, and they don't really go into the details of exactly even how they prepared it, I don't think. But it's still an interesting read because they do have some additional contextual information for that menu, and they seemingly did a little bit more research and dug up a few interesting things about that menu. Although
I wonder if those details are just from the book The Devil in the
Woods. Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah. Let us know, Spencer, if you read that book. Also, they mentioned making pasta, and I don't remember there being any pasta on the menu, so I don't know what that was about. I don't know. That part kind of confused me. I did read the whole thing, but at some point they're talking about making pasta. I don't know if that's like, you know, just an aside or something, but yeah, I don't remember there being any pasta on the menu, and they mentioned making pasta, so that's weird, but maybe they just can't have a meal without pasta or something.
That's a stereotype about people from Chicago. yeah, I don't remember pasta on that at all.
Yeah, I don't think there was any. And my final piece of follow-up, Alan. I finally had pizza from Campus Pizza.
When? What?
Yeah.
Why didn't you? What?
Why didn't I call you immediately while I had some in my mouth? I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago I ordered some like through Uber or Skip, I can't remember which one exactly. And yeah, it was very much as you described, like a good example of that sort of like old school kind of like deep dish Midwestern, you know, heavy layer of cheese on top with most of the toppings underneath, that kind of style of thick crust pizza.
Yep.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I I don't know, maybe sometimes it's better than other times. It seemed like the one that I got was maybe a little undercooked.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it's normally like, but it seemed a little too pale to me, but...
I don't have any stake in Campus Pizza, except that I wanted to stay open because it's so close to my house and I like it.
But, well, yeah, the stake that you have in it is that you eat there all the time. So, yeah.
But, and I don't think this came up in previous conversations, but it has gone through at least a change of ownership, if not more, over the literally 20 years that I've been eating there.
Yeah.
And I do have to say that under previous management, the consistency was a problem,
mm-hmm.
to the point that we would place an order. We would show up early, like earlier than the time they quoted us, just to make sure that it's not sitting on like in the box steaming and getting soft.
Yeah.
We could pick it up early, but then also under previous management, we would also preheat our oven to 500 degrees. And if we needed to crisp it up a little bit more, we would.
Right.
And that sounds dumb, but like, it was just like, it was still easier than preparing our own dinner that night.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it was still delicious, yeah. But under the current management, which has been maybe for the last 2 years, there has been a real like significant and noticeable turnaround, where I find it's so consistently crispy on the bottom, cooked well. Yeah, we definitely don't preheat our ovens anymore. Like, it's actually quite reliable now. So that's sorry that was your experience, but
it wasn't bad, and it wasn't like it wasn't like soggy and like, you know, like drooping or anything. It was like a little undercolored. It wasn't really very crispy. Mm-hmm. What pizza do you normally get there?
Pepperoni and mushroom.
Oh yeah. Okay. So see, and I don't exactly know why I did this. I should have gone for my first pizza from a place. I should have gone like, you know, real traditional.
Didn't we talk about this already? Like when you have a milkshake for the first time, you have an ice cream for the first time, you have the vanilla.
That's right. Yeah, no,
it's
you're
the
right.
Standard by which, yeah.
I did a bad, Alan.
So what did you get? You did a pierogi, a Greek pierogi pizza or something, right? Is that what you
No, got? I did a meat lover's with pineapple. Okay.
Oh, shit. Okay.
I don't know. I was in a weird mood. Anyway. Next time I'll order a pepperoni and pineapple. Totally traditional.
And they'll say, did you mean ham and pineapple when you put this? Yeah.
They'll send me back a message through the app and be like, this can't be right. Anyway, yeah, it was good. I'll order from there again.
It is. Yeah, it's just it's to the style, like it's
exactly
to the,
I mean, if you like that style of pizza, which I do, from, you know, I don't always love that style of pizza. It's not what I want to eat all the time, but you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of nostalgia there for me, so sometimes I got a hankering for it.
Right. Yeah, same.
Cool. Well, I think that's all the follow-up I have. And
well, then do you want me to tack on some more follow-up to just really stretch this into a full episode?
Kinda. Actually, if you have some, maybe this is a full follow-up episode.
Well, can I read you a counterculture review about Sunbake Pita Bakery? Or
yeah, you betcha.
Okay, do we need more introduction?
Sure, I think so. In fact, like, we should probably, and this is something that I was just made aware of today. So I knew that you had started. obviously.
You said that so passive aggressively.
Sorry. Should I try it again?
No, I'm just kidding.
I just found out today that you're posting your food writing, some of which we've been sharing on the show, on like a new blog that you have set up, which is now officially, I guess, called Counterculture.
Yeah. And it was just because like I was doing the writing anyways, and some of it I was doing for that community newsletter, the McKernan Messenger. And then some conversations that I had with people, they were like, oh, I heard you're doing this writing, but like, I have no idea how I'm supposed to read it. And so I just made this, put it up on this site, yagcounterculture.ca. Just counterculture.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to put more stuff on there, that because the items for the McKernan newsletter, I try and keep like adjacent to McKernan, like it'll all be
right
kind of university and Strathcona district. But this website, we can maybe put more stuff up about the broader Edmonton scene.
Yeah, totally. And currently there are three posts.
Yep.
Two of which have been in the McKernan Messenger, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then just put one up this week about Sunbake Pita Bakery. You know that place, Shale?
Yeah, I do know it. I've bought their pitas a lot.
Mm-hmm. Like in grocery stores, you mean, right?
Yeah. And like ordered them for food service operations.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've eaten some of the lunch counter food that they have, but I don't know if I've actually been in there myself. I've eaten that food a few times, like people brought it to people brought it to places. Like I think I'm not 100% sure if it's Sunbake or if it was like a different kind of like Middle Eastern bakery. But when I used to work at the Blue Pear, Darcy, who was the chef there, sometimes would pick up, like, it was like a flatbread and it had like basically seasoned ground beef and ground lamb on it. Right. I'm pretty sure it was from Sunbake.
Like open, like a pizza.
Yeah, it looks like a pizza, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
And we used to have that like fairly. He would pick that up every now and then and bring it, and we would have it as like a staff meal. And I've had it a couple times since then, in other contexts. But I'm sure I must have been in there at some point. But until I go again, I won't know for sure. There's a picture of it on your blog. There's a picture of the front of it. But it's a black and white photo, so it's not for sure like ringing the bell of like, oh yeah, I've definitely been in that place.
One of the I tried not to like be too heavy-handed with this, but the intent here, like, I want this to be like the anti food blog.
Right.
Like, I don't want to take photographs and like be stressing about getting a good photograph and taking dumb videos of myself. Like, I just want to write about food that I've eaten a lot. And so one of the dumb conceits is that all of the photos will be of the storefronts, and they're almost all strip malls and like,
right.
And so it's, we'll see how this progresses. But like I said, anti-food blog.
I think it's a smart idea. Like, I think it like, yeah, if the site is about the writing, it is, you're right. It's hard to get a good picture of like storefronts of these places. And, you know, like you said, you don't want to be a food photographer, you know?
No.
And so, you know, it, I don't know. It makes sense to me that it's, you know, it's just simple black and white photos of the you know, fronts of the buildings or whatever, like, and keeping them black and white also, like, you know, makes it so that you don't have to be so precious about what the photo looks like, you know, it's just there for recognition more than anything.
I think it's good. A few reviews on, we'll see that basically they all look the same, but
yeah,
that's the point. Kind of, I don't know. I really wanted to, like, we talked about how it's, it was reading Counterintelligence by Jonathan Gold and the care given to those write-ups that I really was inspired by. So
yeah. Okay. So do you want to read this piece to us then? The Sunbake Pita Bakery piece?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So Sunbake Pita Bakery, northbound 97th Street, gently crests the Yellowhead overpass, then dips beneath the CN line before emerging in Rosslyn, a hub of Islamic culture in Edmonton. It's a flat landscape of post-war bungalows, but to the south, the sharp geometry of Al Rashid Mosque reaches above the soccer fields and row houses. The strip malls along 134th Avenue include Halal Butchers, a hookah supplier, the Al Safadi supermarket, and one of Edmonton's great lunch counters, Sunbake Pita Bakery, The quality, consistency, and variety at Sunbake can reward not just multiple visits, but years of patronage.
As you can attest to, I guess, Al.
As like the first time I went, this is not in the article. The first time I went there, I was in culinary school. An instructor took me there.
Oh, cool.
Sunbake makes two styles of flatbread. Tanur is the common thin but sturdy pita about 8 inches across, puffed in a deck oven to create the signature pocket. Sunbake produces this version on an industrial scale to be bagged, racked, loaded into vans, and zipped to every corner of the city. Saj pita is made from dough that is stretched thin, nearly to transparency, then cooked on a special griddle. Saj is much more difficult to produce en masse, so it doesn't enjoy the same distribution as tanur, but is available in small quantities at Sunbake. For a quick lunch, Sunbake shawarma are a reliable choice. Whether made with tanur or saj, they are slathered with garlicky thum and filled with shredded chicken and pickles. As far as shawarma go, the chicken at Sunbake is on the dry side, but it's a textural fantasy as the charred flecks of crispy meat mingle with the cool, crunchy pickles. The savory pies called manakish are pitas baked with toppings that run the gamut from simple oil and spice garnishes to the stuff you might find on a deluxe pizza. They're served as open rounds, but folded in half to be eaten. The dough is soft and tender with patches of cracker-like crispiness. For its sheer simplicity and unique flavor, my favorite is the cheese and za'atar pie, with gooey cheese mottled orange and white and a heavy dose of za'atar spice mix. The oil that comes out of the melted cheese is stained by the spices and carries their flavor beautifully. The combination of sour sumac, nutty sesame seeds, and dried herbs is magic. The manakish variations are vast and worth exploring. There's a potato pie with fluffy mounds of barely cooked grated potato dusted with sumac. The hot chicken has a spicy sour profile similar to Tabasco. The creamy spinach and cheese pie has a surprisingly intense and searing lemon flavor. There are other gems to discover quite apart from the pitas. The little turnovers called fatayir are stuffed with meat or cheese and folded into shapes that have always reminded me of fancy hats. I don't know why I wanted to put that in, but on one side of Sunbake, there's an entire counter devoted to bulk roasted nuts, and on the other, a large cooler with bottles of pop, juice, and tangy fermented kefir. There are also trays of delicate leafy pastries made at Paradiso down the street. That's it.
Yeah. Sounds appetizing.
Yeah, I want to go.
Yeah, while you were reading that, I was kind of like, what time is it right now?
They're open like eight to eight every day. Like it's just like, I don't know. It's an institution. Like it's just, it goes all the time. You can walk in anytime.
Totally.
It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, listeners, if you haven't been there, definitely check it out. Mm. Yeah. I think, yeah, I want to make a trip there just so that I can know if I have actually been in their storefront before or not. Right. But yeah,
that like strip, like the... Sorry, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that, like, you know, from the things that I have had, if I'm correct, that they are from there, it's like, yeah, just like you said, like, you know, crispy and fresh and spicy and the ingredients are amazing and everything is well produced. And even like the pitas that they, you know, bake that they sell wholesale to food service and grocery stores and stuff like that are like of excellent quality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, making me hungry.
And yeah, I don't know, like the like shawarma obviously are fairly common in Edmonton, but I hadn't come across the manakish, like the kind of like pita pocket pizzas basically.
Yeah.
And maybe they are more common than I know, but that was the first place that I had them and like really, really fell in love with them. Yeah, that strip, like the few blocks along 134th Avenue, like you really get the sense of you kind of used to, there's certain areas of Edmonton and it kind of ebbs and flows, but like where there's like a distinct, like the, like an immigrant community, like really, you can feel it like in the shops and the people that you're buying from and stuff, like you know that it's like a really distinct neighborhood.
like a tech community. Like it's got like, you know, a, sort of like a small town vibe where like, you know, you're a tourist, but everybody else who's there kind of everybody knows everybody or something like that.
Kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that those few blocks on 134th Ave are like that, like the, between Sunbake and El Safadi. And yeah, it's.
What's Paradiso? It's
so it's like, I think that they're like, subtitle or whatever is like 11 Levantine Suites.
Okay.
So it's like, it's Lebanese confection. Like it's like baklava, gotcha. Like that kind of style of confection. Most of it is based on that kind of, I don't know if there's probably an Arabic word for it, but like the phyllo pastry, like brushed with butter, drenched in sugar, loads of nuts. There's other styles of confection in the shop, but that's the bulk of it is like what I would describe as variations on baklava. But and there's a couple of those like on that, like literally within a few blocks, there's Paradiso. There's another one called Cedar Sweets. Yeah.
Cool. Man, I'm hungry now. I think I might have to break for lunch.
Meet you there.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.